Multiracial marriages are on the rise. According to a recent report from the Brookings Institution, the millennial generation is the most diverse adult generation in America's history. We're having a conversation about interracial relationships on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cheryl Cashin is a law professor at Georgetown University. She writes about race relations and inequality in America. Her latest book is called Loving Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. Cheryl, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Well, help us understand how common or uncommon interracial marriage is today in America.
Well, one-fifth of all new marriages or cohabitants, there's a lot of cohabitating going on, are between a person of a different race or ethnicity. That's a tremendous increase since, 50 years ago when the Loving case was decided. And it's on the rise. Other forms of intimacy are also on the rise. Interracial dating, cross-racial adoption, friendship. I actually think that friendship between people of different races is even more impactful than interracial marriage because there's a lot less at stake. And it may seem trite, but if you look at millennials, almost all millennials know someone of a different race in a friendly way that their grandparents didn't. So we're on this trajectory where interracial mixing is on the rise, and there's all this social science that shows what common sense tells you, that when people know someone and interact in an intimate way with someone of a different race, it tends to reduce prejudice, reduce anxiety in dealing with others, increase empathy.
So are millennials appreciating more diversity in their life, appreciating, understanding diversity around them? What do you think is leading to these friendships?
Well, each cohort of young people is more diverse than the one that came before it. And so, I think if you look at babies that are born today, I don't have this stats right in my head, but they may be majority, minority, or close to it, right? And so with more people, there's more opportunity. So I don't think millennials give it a lot of thought.
Hmm.
And then the generation younger than millennials, my children's generation, it's just what they are exposed to. Diversity is normal for them. As segregated as we are, a lot of young people experience difference. And if not in their school or their neighborhood, certainly in media, and the culture. Social science that shows that people can develop ties of affection with a character that they see in media, or someone that they admire, Oprah Winfrey, and that has been shown to reduce prejudice. So there's just density of opportunity for younger people, and there is a Pew study that shows that millennials, the majority of millennials, when asked about the impending change in demographics in the country, don't react to that with fear. Most of them are fine with it. It's just what they expect.
The latest census data shows more than a third of interracial marriages include one white person and one Hispanic person. Should we concern ourselves with the makeup of interracial relationships and what that means?
I don't think people should be concerned about individuals' choices of who to love, And what's refreshing to me is that more and more, most people just experience that with a shrug, right? It's that's what's changed profoundly in the last, I would say, decade or so. There's just a majority acceptance. My analogy is to the change in attitudes about same-sex marriage. Now, yes, there's some people who still can't accept it, but we went very quickly in about a five-year period from where a majority of people oppose same-sex marriage to a majority of people accept it. And we've been there for a while with interracial marriage. So I don't think it should be a matter of concern, and most people aren't concerned about it. In fact, there's a large percentage of people, I'm sure many of your listeners have this experience, know someone who is dating or married to a person of a different race. A lot of people have a relative who has done that, and there's studies that show that just knowing someone who has made that choice, even if you personally wouldn't make it, has a tends to engender acceptance. And so this is happening. There's a mathematical concept called a geometric progression, where, you know, initially, in the early stages of a geometric progression, the change is barely perceptible, but eventually you reach a tipping point where a phenomenon or a culture becomes the norm. And I think we're in the stages of a geometric progression, and, you know, in 5-10 years out, it will be even more normal.
Cheryl Cashin is a law professor at Georgetown University. She writes about race relations and inequality in America. You can join this conversation about interracial marriage. Are you married to someone who is of a different race? Did you think twice about the relationship, or was it a non-issue? How do people in your community respond to your partnership? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cheryl, this notion that individual choices drive a person to love whom they love brings us to, I think, the crux of your book. You wrote the book on the landmark Supreme Court decision, Loving versus Virginia, which overturns state laws banning marriage between whites and people of color. What history should we use in context to put the current trends into context?
Well, in the beginning, when we in colonial America, for the first 6 decades or so, for example, in colonial Virginia, there was a lot of mixing. You had white indentured servants toiling alongside indigenous people and black slaves, and they had a habit of mixing. You know, they would get drunk together, steal hogs together, run off to the Indians together, sometimes have sex, sometimes marry. And most pointedly, they would rise up occasionally and rebel against their masters, against harsh treatment. And so when the plutocrats of that era, the people who could afford to own bonded people, decided to move from indentured servitude to chattel slavery, they had this problem of alliance, and they created the concept of whiteness to solve this class conflict between wealthy planters and poor whites. So whiteness didn't exist for the first 6 decades, so they created it, and part of the laws to create a color line was to ban and penalize interracial marriage and interracial sex. And so this color line had a political function to divide and conquer that continues, but the habit, each new generation had to be taught that it's not acceptable to even play checkers with a person of a different color, much less align politics. And so we've had these miscegenation laws, is what they're called, laws banning whites from marrying blacks and other people of color. And for like 300 years, particularly in Virginia, at one point as many as 41 states had these laws that criminalized interracial marriage, and it was part of the regime of white supremacy. And in the Loving case, the Supreme Court 50 years ago, in a case involving Richard and Mildred Loving, many of you may have seen the movie.
And I'm going to have to pause you right there as we look at the Loving case and take a look at the context for that today. Cheryl Cashin stays with us. She's a law professor at Georgetown, writes about race relations. Her book is Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. How do people in your community respond to your partnership in your interracial marriage? Join in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. The dating app Tinder published survey findings this week about the tendencies of people who date online. It found online matchmaking services make people more open-minded about dating someone outside their own race or ethnicity. Almost 80% of people surveyed who use Tinder said they have been on a date with someone of a different race or ethnicity in the context of their whole dating life history. Of people who used any dating app, 61% said they were open to interracial dating or marriage. Anna Holmes is editorial director of Topic.com, which is part of Topic Studios. She's founder of the online women's magazine Jezebel. Her recent op-ed in the New York Times is called Black with Some White Privilege. Anna, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, did I put the stress correctly in that headline?
I'm not sure. That was, I don't write headlines, so
okay.
You have to ask the editor.
Well, there were some asterisks in there, and I thought there was some emphasis. So tell us your personal story in your opinion piece in the Times. What should people know about your family and who you are?
You want my kind of family background?
And to give us some context here.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Northern California in the early 70s to a white mother from Ohio, and my father is African-American. He is from South Carolina. They had met, I believe it was 1966. They married in 1969, which was 2 years after Loving v. Virginia, and then I was born about 3 years after that. So at the time when I was growing up, and also this is, you know, specific to where I was growing up, which was a very small town in Northern California, there weren't that many mixed-race couples, especially, black-white couples, and there certainly weren't very many children of those marriages or relationships that I was around. So I felt, I wouldn't say I felt completely different, because that would suggest that I felt bad about who I was, which wasn't the case. But I definitely was aware of the fact that my family makeup was very unusual for that time. And when I did meet other mixed kids, which was pretty rarely, I felt particularly connected to them because of the fact that we were felt so rare.
You moved fluidly, I think you write about, among white people with ease in a way that you said my blackness wasn't at the foreground. What do you make of that? What do you mean by that?
That's totally a supposition that my blackness wasn't at the foreground. That's just the way that I felt. Uh-huh. I mean, I guess you'd have to ask the actual people that I interacted with throughout my childhood. But the town I grew up in was very, very, very white. There were very, very few black people. There were very few people. There were very few Asian Americans, very few Jewish people. Because it was California, there were a little more, Hispanics. But because I came out of the womb, I guess you could say, fairly light-skinned, I don't think that you could look at me and know that I was black. The only people I found and still find to this day who look at me and know that I'm black are other black people. But because of this kind of like privilege of colorism, if you want to call it that, of being very light-skinned and passing in some ways, my ethnic background was not the first thing that people saw and judged me by when they first interacted with me. So you know, most of my friends were white. I mean, I'd say the large majority, if not all of them, growing up were white. Teachers, same thing. And so it was only when I was 18 years old and graduated from high school and moved to the East Coast, to New York, that I really was around not just a black community, but communities of color in general.
How are we talking about the privilege of colorism today? Are we being honest about it?
I'm not sure that people who aren't African American or people of color are talking about colorism at all. And so, you know, the only conversations that I'm privy to are the ones that are happening with people in my cohort, meaning other biracial people or other people of color. I think we talk about it in at least people that I speak to talk about it in a pretty straightforward, honest way. It's really hard to deny that it exists. And for those who don't know what colorism is, it's the kind of like fake hierarchy in which lighter-skinned black people or lighter-skinned people of color are seen as being closer to whiteness and therefore more acceptable. And you know, you can see this play out in many ways, whether it's the ways in which, you know, Hollywood, like the sort of actresses or actors that Hollywood tends to put forward or celebrate, tend to be on the lighter end of the scale. I mean, I think that's changing somewhat, but, you know, ideas of beauty are very much rooted in what is considered to be attractive to white people, and lighter-skinned black and Latino people therefore appear to be closer to whiteness and more acceptable.
Let's bring in Karen in Madison, who has been waiting with her story. Karen, go ahead.
Hello. I'm a teacher, and I'm in an interracial marriage. Where I live in Madison or Sun Prairie, no one takes a second look. Even when I'm at school, when the race talk comes up and the white kids find out that I am in an interracial marriage, I'm married to a white man, they're like, they think it's so cool. In Milwaukee, on the other hand, when I have to discuss race and the problems and good things about it, the overwhelming majority of black kids think, they act as if I'm betraying the race somehow. And here's another story. My white friend, she's going to get married to a black man. I said, where did you meet? She said, blackpeoplemeet.com. I just wanted to make those two comments.
Karen, thank you so much for bringing these two points up. And let's bring in Cheryl Cashin back into the conversation. Opposition to marriages between people of different ethnicities has a strong history in racism. How does racism factor into growing rates of interracial unions?
Well, can I respond to the caller's comment before answering that question?
Yeah.
It's interesting that black kids in Milwaukee expressed opposition to her being an interracial marriage, and I just want to point out, Milwaukee, unfortunately, is one of the most segregated cities in America, and, so a lot of black kids in that milieu aren't experiencing integration, you know, and there are also, a lot of them probably experience discrimination and oppression, so, you know, there is this element of particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement, sort of people being woke about things going on, you know, I could see some kids reacting in this way, and it's unfortunate. But I think that is not indicative of where, you know, all black people are, or a lot of black people are. So could you repeat your question? I'm sorry.
No, I was just trying to get your context of how history in racism is part of this conversation as well.
Well, so, you know, here, you create a color line, and I want to reemphasize this point. Race relations were designed to be broken by plutocrats who wanted to divide struggling people of all colors so that they would not ally to demand more of plutocrats. And that political function of a color line continues to this day, the divide and conquer politics. And And so, you know, you have habits of people staying among themselves, you know. And so, you know, there is still racism. There is still, you know, we still live with the vestiges of white supremacy. And you still have, you know, group identity. And I'm not saying group identity is a bad thing. But, you know, all of these ideas are out there, and people grab on to different things depending on the context. But overall, the trajectory is one of increasing cross-racial intimacy and increasing acceptance. And people who experience interracial intimacy tend to acquire what I call cultural dexterity and acceptance of difference. And overall, you know, there are individual counterexamples, but overall, you know, this trend is for the good because it helps expand empathy. And, you know, the bottom line point for me is that culturally dexterous white people who have an intimate relationship with a person of a different color, it tends to predict they're more apt to engage in collective action for racial justice. And so I think, you know, we're in a long arc, you know, but I'm optimistic about the future because cultural dexterity is growing.
We're talking about interracial relationships, interracial marriage, where it stands in 2018 with Anna Holmes and Cheryl Cashin. Anna is editorial director of Topic.com, which is part of Topic Studios. She founded the online women's magazine Jezebel, and she recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on the discussion of biracial identity. Cheryl Cashin is also with us, a Georgetown University law professor who writes about race relations and inequality in America. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have your ideas about interracial relationships evolved over the years? What's pushed you to change your mind? What is your story? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Sarah, who joins us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I am so sleepy, so I hope I make sense.
No problem.
I had a Mexican boyfriend recently, and we broke up. And I have to say that in my town, I didn't really get any eyebrows from it. But I think if I'd been dating a black man, I really would have. But our town is interesting because it's one third black, one third Hispanic, one third white. And I teach in the public schools, and we have 1% white kids in the school. So obviously, most of the white families are sending their kids to private schools, and I'm worried about that in light of that. It seems like the government is trying to really push private schools, voucher schools, charter schools, and I just read that Puerto Rico just adopted a plan to privatize their entire school, their public school system, and that Betsy DeVos.
Sarah, I'm going to have to stop you there, and thank you so much for bringing up these points. I want to go to Anna with some reaction. Anna, go ahead.
I'm not sure what I'm exactly reacting to. Am I reacting to what the caller just said? I wasn't sure if there was a question there.
Right. So basically, she was just pointing out that she finds, there's 1% white people in the school district compared to 30% in the neighborhood, and seeing differences in the makeup of her school and in her small community, and what that relates to in interracial relationships has an impact there.
Yeah, I can't speak so much to like schooling and segregation. Although, you know, interestingly, one of the subjects in the documentary series that we did, The Loving Generation, is I would say the preeminent foremost writer and thinker about education and segregation in the United States, Nicole Hannah Jones of the New York Times, and she is also a member of what we call the Loving Generation. So she's thought really deeply about how kids are encouraged or not encouraged to mix.
We have a clip of her talking about just that. Let's listen.
Okay.
just because you marry a black person doesn't mean that you understand race any better than anyone else. And I think that's probably one of the biggest myths around white women who have children with black men, is that that somehow means that they are better at this. And they're not. They're just someone who fell in love with a man who happens to be black.
What do you make of that?
She's talking about the idea that the white parent in an interracial marriage, the white parent of a black child, is assumed to have some sort of understanding of race and the realities faced by people of color in the United States that other white people don't. And she's taking issue with that assumption that, you know, seeing in effect that just be, you know, the one thing that a lot of these white parents have in common is now that they are more racially evolved, but that they happen to fall in love with a black person. In this case, she's talking about white women who are mothers to black children. That seems to be, and this is totally non-scientific, but it seems to be a more common combination, at least in the couples who were married or partnered right before and in like a decade or so after Loving v. Virginia. And certainly the mixed people that I know, for the large majority of them, had a white mother and a black father. It wasn't so much the other way around. But, you know, who you go to school with affects who you find attractive in some ways. I mean, there are other factors, like social factors, society, culture, et cetera. And I would be lying if I didn't say that growing up, because I was surrounded by white children, that my ideas of what was attractive romantically weren't mainly focused on white males as opposed to males of color, because I just wasn't around them very much. But I can't speak so much to the issue of segregation in education, yeah. At least not with any sort of expertise.
Well, and you bring up the Loving Generation and this documentary series from Topic.com. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this is trying to get at and explore?
Sure. And first, I should apologize for the loud crashing sound you may have heard a couple minutes ago. I have two kittens, and they knocked over a large vase.
nice.
That I have to clean up later. Of course, they do it when I'm on the radio. So The Loving Generation is a four-part documentary series that we debuted on Topic.com earlier this month and also on Facebook. It tells stories that I've been wanting to tell for some time, because I had always felt growing up that there was something very interesting about that generation who were born right before and after Loving v. Virginia to a black parent and a white parent. As I got older, I encountered more of them, especially once I moved to the East Coast as opposed to my tiny town on the West Coast. And I realized that we didn't tend to really talk to one another about what our experiences had been. I may have felt connected to somebody or more connected to somebody because of that shared history, but the shared history was never really articulated. And it turns out, in some cases, wasn't exactly a shared history after all, because it really depended on where in the country we grew up, where we were born, the economic circumstances that we grew up in, whether our extended families accepted our parents' interracial marriage.
And we're going to have to pause right there. Thank you, Anna Holmes and Cheryl Cashin. Stay with us. Anna Holmes is editorial director of Topic.com, which is part of Topic Studios. Cheryl Cashin is a law professor at Georgetown University who writes about race relations. You can join this conversation, 800-642-1234. Back after this news update. We're talking about interracial relationships this hour of the morning show. A documentary series on Topic.com talked with children born to one black and one white parent between the 1960s through the mid-80s. Let's listen to comic book writer and novelist Matt Johnson.
When I was a kid, no mixed woman would go out with me. They wouldn't talk to me, and I was fine, too. It didn't matter. They would not talk to me. They would only date the preferred race that they were trying to join.
Just a quick clip there. Anna Holmes stays with us for this conversation. Anna is editorial director of Topic.com, and she recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called Black with Some White Privilege. Georgetown Law professor Cheryl Cashin is here as well. Her book is Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are your parents from different races? In what way does that change the way you see the world or how the world sees you? How does it inform you today in 2018? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Anna, back to you, going back to novelist Matt Johnson. You talked to him as part of your documentary series. What did you find through Matt's comments about race?
What did I find through his comments? I actually like to speak more broadly about like everyone's comments about race.
Sure.
in the series, not necessarily single his out, because you know his is one story, and I think that when we first started thinking about doing the documentary series, there was an implicit assumption that I'm not even sure we were totally aware of, that a lot of our stories would be very similar. And what we found out, we meaning myself and our director, one of our co-directors, Lacey Schwartz, was that everyone had a kind of different experience. So he's really only speaking for himself there, as opposed to the larger cohort that we're trying to illuminate the stories of.
Were there some aha moments for you through the process? Because you could have been one of those faces in your documentary series.
I don't know if there were any aha moments. I mean, there were definitely moments where I felt like, yes, yep, I get that, identify with that. And then there were some, there's some where I didn't, because, and those tended to be between or about folks that we had featured in the documentary who had grown up in very different circumstances than I had. Perhaps their extended family on the white parent side had rejected them in some way. And although my extended family on my white side didn't so much reject me, immediately, which is to say, it was less fraught because they were 2,000 miles away, mm. as opposed to in the same municipality. So there were definitely aha moments. I think that you know the most recent episode, which we just released yesterday, which is called The Obama Era, and is about this generation's feelings about the election of Barack Obama, who himself is biracial. He doesn't really fit into the generation we're talking about because he's a little bit older, but he represented something really important to us and to a lot of other Americans, you know, black or white.
Let's take a moment to hear how former President Obama talked about that in a speech during his first presidential campaign in March of 2008.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters.
So, Cheryl, how did President Obama connect with people of color and at the same time with white Americans?
Well, you know, Barack Obama, like many biracial people, lived this duality, and he understood white people a lot better than a lot of African Americans because he had lived with them. And he could see, he also, you know, had to live in that world. And this sort of validates Anna's piece, and I really liked your piece, Anna. So he understood that there were a lot of white people who would vote for him in a way that, you know, a lot of black people just didn't believe it could happen. And so, you know, he goes off and runs and just connects with people. And, you know, this is what's so interesting about America. We have these two narratives. We have, you know, a 300-year history of constructing white supremacy and structures to divide people. But we've also always had you know, what I call ardent integrators, a class of radicals that would cross lines. And Barack Obama was, you know, probably going to go down in history as one of the most famous line crossers. But he represents, again, what makes me hopeful about, as bad as things are in terms of race relations and political division, he represents what most gives me hope about the future of this country, that there's a possibility of creating what political science call a coalition of the ascendant, you know, and I think California represents this. California went from being majority white to gridlock to majority minority to functional again in politics, you know, and with rising interracial intimacy, yeah, everybody has individual experiences, but over time and across whole populations, it does raise acceptance of difference. And I think we're going to get to a tipping point where a critical mass, not all whites, but a critical mass of people rejects this division and accepts that we're going to be a very diverse country and wants to be part of the coalition that pursues, you know, common sense policies that, you know, promote all you know,
and
what people want.
Yeah, Anna, the topic documentary includes people talking about President Obama's mixed race heritage and his self-identification as a black man. How do the people you interviewed view him, and how did that come off?
Well, the majority of the people that we interviewed, and I mean, I guess I'll go as far as to extrapolate to the generation, do consider themselves to be black. They have a black identity more than they have a mixed identity. But a lot of that is due to the fact that up until very recently, the United States government considered biracial or mixed children, if they had a black, drop of black blood in them, to be black. Certainly when I was growing up, the sorts of forms that one is tasked with filling out, either myself or my parents, didn't give an option for anything really other than black or white, but it's also a political decision. As you get older, I think that, you know, in the year 2000 is when the census began really allowing for Americans to self-identify as being of more than one race. And so you saw groups of people who were more likely to identify as mixed race than as, let's say, black or white. But with us, we're a little bit older. We identify as black, and Obama's identifying as such on the census as well in 2010, while also acknowledging his mixed race heritage, felt completely in line with what our experience was and has been because of you know, not just our politics, but the fact that the U.S. government considered us to be black for so long.
I want each of you to get enough time to spend some thoughtful discussion on this. What you want people to take away from biracial unions today and this growth from friendship that Cheryl talked about at the beginning of the hour to other relationships, whether it be marriage or long-term relationships, what should we be thinking about today? Cheryl, you first.
Well, biracial people are one of the fastest growing populations in this country. And I put this in the context, there's a confluence of forces that I hope is or will disrupt this tired script of race being used to divide people. And the confluence of forces, rising interracial intimacy, immigration and demographic change, and frankly, the dying off of older generations of whites that grew up expecting to be dominant. And with this confluence of forces, including activism, including political engagement by people who reject discrimination, I think we're going to get to a tipping point where it becomes easier, not harder, for people of different races to ally together to pursue common sense.
And Anna Holmes, how about you? What do you want people to take away and understand and think about as they approach the relationships in their lives and the lives of their loved ones?
I'm not sure that I can be prescriptive about what people should take away from the growing numbers of mixed race children and interracial couples, other than I agree that I think that we're going to hit a tipping point at some point in the future where the diversity of America is undeniable and in fact embraced. But I'm not sure that's going to happen in my lifetime. I'm in my early 40s, so I guess some would consider me to be middle aged or on the younger side, even though I don't. But I'm somewhat pessimistic about what's being described, only because I think that for a lot of us, the reaction to the election of Barack Obama, the hatred that was thrown his way, and the racism and bigotry that bubbled up from various fever swamps and from the Republican Party even, was really a kind of blow and a sobering reminder that we have a long ways to go. So I hope to see it in my lifetime, that tipping point. I'm not confident that I will.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Cheryl Cashin, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Holmes is editorial director of Topic.com, which is part of Topic Studios. She's founder of the online women's magazine Jezebel. She wrote a recent op-ed in the New York Times called Black with Some White Privilege. And Cheryl Cashin is a professor of law at Georgetown University. She writes about race relations and inequality in America. And her latest book on this is called Loving Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.